So, it's Q&A time, probably the most exciting time. This is my favorite part of Café Scientifique. The way we're going to do the Q&A tonight is Ashley has a microphone in the center aisle there on the podium. There's Ashley. So if you have a question, you can head up to that center aisle, ask your question, we'll get an answer. Please try to speak into the microphone nice and loudly so everybody can hear, also so we can get it recorded for the podcast so people can listen to it and enjoy it later. And then we can start a little line going up there. That'll be fine. If for any reason you can't or don't want to leave your seat but still want to ask a question, just flag Ashley down. She can bring the microphone to you so that everybody can hear as well. I want to make sure everybody can hear through that microphone. All right. Also, try to ask one question until everybody gets a chance, and then we can start on seconds, just to keep it fair, to give everybody a chance to get a question in, because I'm kicking you all out at 9 o'clock. Just kidding. We'll see how it goes. But if we have a question, I'll turn it back over to Margie.
Sticking within our culture, what about the kind of symbolism that is not like a headless ghoul or like body that is covered in blood, but something like a clown, because chlorophobia is something that can scare a lot of people.
Yeah. So is the question why are we afraid of things like clowns? Or yeah. So I've actually looked into chlorophobia a lot because it's incredibly interesting that we are afraid of clowns, something that's supposed to bring us joy and happiness, and yet people find it terrifying. And it's really, there was a study that was done in the UK that asked children what they thought of this clown motif that was in the hospital. And the children, I mean, they have never seen it. They've never seen any of these kind of scary clown movies that are out there today. But even they found the imagery disturbing and upsetting. And so it was really like, why? Why are clowns so scary? And there are a couple different theories as to why we are afraid of clowns. For one thing, clowns, physical clowns that are in front of us, they're essentially wearing a mask. A lot of our communication depends on being able to read other people's facial expressions. We really do depend on that to know that what we're saying is landing, and then try and figure out how the person is experiencing what we're saying so that we can then respond appropriately. With clowns, their facial expressions are masked. They have these exaggerated eyebrows, exaggerated smiles. We really don't know how they're reacting to what we're saying. And many times their expressions don't match a lot of their physical attributes. And it's just this incredible dissonance that's happening. They're looking this one way, they're saying these things, they're doing these things, and it's all just not quite matching up. And so that makes us very afraid because we don't know what they're going to do. We can't predict their behavior because we can't read their expressions. Also, we do have a very strong now kind of construction of the clown as a scary character. Most of the clown kind of images today are scary clowns. So kids today are growing up with the idea that the clowns are scary. So clowns are scary for. And then you also have kind of these historical iconic clown characters that have been charlatans and troublemakers, and just this idea of the clown as this kind of character of that we shouldn't trust. So, yeah. But I think that it is interesting that you do see that even children find clowns scary. So. Yeah. I can.
I just wanted to ask about car accidents and rubberneckers.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you see a bad accident, you're coming up on it, you don't want to look at it, but you have to see what's going on. And then, I mean, moving past the accidents, I don't think anyone feels good about it, or has the endorphins or whatever you're saying about that. So I was just curious as to, do you have any idea why people are so, you know, where they'll stop traffic for miles and just to look into this car?
Yeah, I don't think that rubberneckers are experiencing a fight or flight response. I think that what that is that we are drawn so much to novel things. You know, something's different. Oh my God, what's happening? You know, it's look over here, look over there. It's something different, so it's going to capture our attention much more. Something, you know, that is then also tragic is also going to, that's going to emotionally make us want to be interested and look at it and see what's going on. But really anything that is abnormal, anything that is out of the ordinary, that is taking us out of our very routine lives is going to capture our attention, and we're going to want to see it. We also want to see these types of things because then we can share them with other people. Be like, oh my gosh, did you see this that happened? I was right there. We want stories to tell, so.
Mm-hmm. It seems like we've been focusing dopamines and endorphins on the visual aspects of fear. I was wondering about any other modality like the auditory. I'm from the genre when the shadow and things like that, they scared us to pieces and we were terrified. We were less terrified when it became visual than when it was just auditory.
Oh,
can you?
Absolutely. No, I think that, well, fight or flight can be triggered by any of our senses, and just by hearing a story, by reading a story, we can actually move ourselves into that response. Definitely, you know, not just seeing something scary. If we feel something that is kind of gross, I mean, disgust is a little bit different than fear, but our touch can move us into that kind of response. We can get the same kind of benefits from that. I mean, in haunted houses, you're trying to engage every sense. So sight, sound, touch, smell. Smell is a big one. Smell can really, I mean, that you smell something disgusting, and that's gonna move you real quickly. So it's not just seeing something. It is definitely all of the senses and reading. You know, if you look at the Gothic novels and the graveyard poets, they were scaring people just with their words. And it's because our imagination is so powerful, we can create you know, just far scarier things in our mind than what we see. And you see a lot of the great horror movies are the ones that don't show the monster. You know, they're letting the viewer create that monster in their mind, and it's always going to be more terrifying. So yeah, no, you can utilize all of our senses to self-scare.
Next question. This is a cultural question. Have you found that people in from different parts of the world react differently? Such, if I could use the example of an American versus a German, could you typify that?
So this has been something that I've been thinking about a lot because coming back from Japan, I was paying a lot of attention to how people were responding when going through haunted houses and riding roller coasters. And you see that in general, the physical response is pretty uniform. I mean, we all have very kind of instinctual responses. We, you know, draw ourselves in. We are going to protect ourselves and our essential organs because that's what, you know, has led to a lot of our survival. This fight or flight response is very, very much evolved to protect us. So that kind of response is very similar, but what I did notice some differences in group behavior. In Japan, I noticed that the groups would huddle together in a circle more tightly. You know, in the U.S., you see a lot of people they'll be close to each other, but there seemed to be a more kind of touching and just a kind of willingness to be very close, men and women. I thought that was really interesting. The men in Japan very comfortable with each other and just touching each other and being scared together. So that was a little bit different. But I think that the physical response is pretty hardwired.
Okay, in part B, are there certain kinds of things that are scary that are common or native to all populations versus things that might be learned in certain populations?
Yeah, there's really interesting research happening right now. You know, we definitely have a large category of socially constructed fears that change based on time and place. But there are researchers who are now trying to see if some of our fears are kind of hardwired. They did these studies showing pictures to people, and within the pictures they were like a collage, and the collages had some of them would have images of flowers and like happy things, and then some would have images of snakes, of spiders, of scary things. And they found that the people could more quickly find the scary things rather than the happy things. And so this led to this idea, well, are we kind of, have we evolved to fear certain things that historically have posed a great threat to us? And you also see that there are, you know, people who have fear of snakes who have never been exposed to a snake, have no history with snakes. And so that is, you know, calling into the question of whether or not we have evolved to fear some things. But it's not a confirmed, it's debated. So you do have researchers who are kind of pursuing this. I think that they're calling it like a fear module, or somehow basically that we are evolving to recognize those things that might pose the greatest threat to us. Because then another researcher came along and did a similar study, and instead of natural fears, so like snakes or, you know, nature-oriented things, snakes, spiders, bugs, she replaced it with things like guns and needles and things that are modern to, are relevant to our life, and people could more quickly find those. So it could be that we are just kind of better at finding things that we think are going to threaten us, but when it comes to actually specifics, it's hard to say that we have these universally shared fears.
excuse me. When it comes to fear, I mean, fear can be perceived in a lot of different ways. But when people go out into the world and try to seek these various thrills in their life, I guess to get excitement or whatever, is it possible that one of the reasons why we often seek to be afraid of other things is to sort of mask some sort of, like, inner feeling, like emotion or something, like basically suppress something. Like, we're basically, like, trying to find something to, like, get our minds off that. Is that, like, a possibility?
Like, we're seeking out these experiences as kind of a distraction?
In a way, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's definitely why I went to the scare house for the first time. And when I was working on my dissertation, I was just... It's like, I have got to get out of here. You know, I was so tired of just writing and focusing. It was like, I need to do something that's going to take me out of this current kind of monotonous writing. and so I was like, I'm going to a haunted house. And it was great. You know, I came out feeling, you know, reinvigorated. And so, yeah, I think that we definitely are seeking these things. Because for many people today, our lives are incredibly routine and incredibly boring. Again, there are major differences depending on, you know, where you are in the social hierarchy and what your life is like. But for people who have the 9-to-5, who are working behind a computer for 8 hours a day, we are seeking out something that is going to give us a thrill, to give us a change of pace. And you know, that's, I think, you know, it's nice to have opportunities to do that.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of the 9-to-5, I was wondering, I work in the corporate world, and to break up the monotony, I at least I'm lucky enough to have the, I guess, opportunity to be the one who scares my coworkers, at least, you know, in the cubicles.
Every office has one.
So, well, yeah, they know I'm on a list. But I didn't know if you could talk to the opposite end of that, the people who enjoy scaring other people. I mean, I enjoy being scared myself, but I also enjoy seeing that response, and if it's similar effects on the body biologically, and then also with the, you know, still sharing that experience,
yeah,
even if you're a part of it and the one instigating it. So,
yes,
touch on that.
I think about that a lot, and by the way, auditions for Scare House are the third week in August, so please come out. I think about that a lot, and I wanted to include a chapter in my book on the people who do the scaring, and unfortunately, there wasn't room for it, so that's book two. But there is, I think, a kind of personality and a combination of characteristics that go into someone who enjoys scaring people, and it's not what I think a lot of people assume it to be, kind of some you know, dark kind of goth, I just want to go scare people. It's not like that. We have such a huge range of actors at Scarehouse, and they come from all walks of life and work in so many different types of jobs. And so the only, at times it seems like the only thing that really they have in common is that they like to scare people. I think that there is a range in that enjoyment, healthy to potentially problematic. But for a lot of people, it can be really fun. It can be a real great time to be like, oh, I scared you. And we've got some actors here that I can connect you with, and you can ask them about their experiences, because it is something that interests me. And I have tried to scare people, and I can't do it. So I've tried to sit there and do the whole thing, and I just end up laughing, or I end up going on a tangent about something and just saying random things to make this isn't scary. So it is something that I'm interested in. I want to find out more about. So,
I am an actor, not a scare person. I don't go for scary movies and things like that, but I like being on stage. I like it very much. And I'm thinking that the experience of my going on stage is somewhat similar to going through a scare house, except that I prepare for it very, very lengthily.
Yeah.
And I'm not really afraid of it, but I probably get the other chemical reactions that...
Yeah.
Would you have a comment on that?
I think, well, public speaking, people are terrified of public speaking. Zach and I were just actually talking about that, how, you know, it's one of the often, the most cited fears is fear of public speaking. So I think that it definitely does move people into a kind of fight or flight response. And it can be a thrill in and of itself. A lot of people are really terrified of it. So I don't know. I think something that people can try doing to overcome kind of that fear and feel good about it.
Okay. Just a comment and a question for you. The gentleman had the first question on the clown.
Yeah.
If he wants to come down to our haunted house, the Haunted School of Terror in Weird, West Virginia, we have a clown room, and he can learn all he wants about why clowns terrify you. Appreciate you stopping down. But how do you feel that, as far as like, and I'll be specific, you have things like 9/11 that happen. Why do certain agencies, I feel like the government or the news agencies, tend to take fear and use it as a control, over people. Why do they do that? You know, what's their gain out of that? Is it more to control us? You know, I'd just like to hear your comment on it.
Using fear to essentially promote a political agenda is something that we've really done forever, because it's a way to essentially, you know, meet whatever political goal you want. You know, if you want to achieve X, Y, or Z, then you introduce the topic that is going to scare people to make sure that they move in that direction. It's just a very effective way to sway opinion, is just to scare them. And so you do see that. There are a lot of books out there. Peter Stearns writes a lot about American fear and how, politicians and not just politicians, though. I mean, anyone who wants to convince someone to do something can tap into that person's fear and generally make them do it. And it's just to achieve political goals, and just basically win.
This is a question about your research more broadly. What's the unit of measurement for fear?
Oh, that's a great question. So, and it differs depending on what discipline you're talking about. So you have, a lot of neurologists who just want to study what's happening in the brain. So maybe if the brain wave reaches this point, that person is experiencing fear. But it's not as simple as that. You know, you can't say, well, this person's heart rate went up to this, and that means that they were afraid. Or this person, experienced this amount of sweating, and so that's what they're going to focus on. But that's not really the full story. So then you have psychologists who say, well, we need to ask people what they're afraid of, and so it would be self-report. So what are you afraid of, X, Y, or Z? And then It's going based on what they're saying. But then that could be potentially a flawed measure too, because maybe they're just saying that for some other reason and they don't actually have a physical response to that fear. So you have someone who says, oh, I'm so claustrophobic, but you put them in an elevator and they're fine. So then you have to ask yourself, well, what are we measuring? Why are they saying that they're afraid of this when they're not having a reaction? So the level of measurement is going to change depending on the discipline, and that's something that, I mean, I spend so much time just trying to define fear. I mean, what is it? And you really, you can't come up with a solid definition of it. I prefer definitions that more often depend on self-report, because I feel like, well, I'm a sociologist and I like people, so I like to hear what they have to say. But it is going to vary, and a lot of my research is trying to have these two disciplines kind of speak to each other and say, okay, well, this person is having this response, but they're not really afraid of this thing, and what is that about? So, yeah, that's a challenge. And that also makes then comparative studies of fear almost impossible, because, you know, you're measuring different things, so...
So you have gotten the experience to be able to, you know, read I don't know how many people's, you know, what they're scared of and witness their responses and everything. In doing so, have you ever found sort of a common unifying theme between all these disparate experiences?
Well, I've seen some trends, like, across years, you know, things that are more popular at some times than others. Generally, though, the bigger kinds of patterns are around kind of iconic characters. So, you know, everybody's afraid of zombies, and you can kind of, I do a word count. Okay, how many times did zombies appear in this year's survey? And so you can kind of measure what kind of characters are the most popular. And then you do see kind of trends if you look across time in mostly like comic books and in movies, what characters are really popular. It changes, and it often is changing for a couple different reasons. It can be changing because of kind of political influence. So, you know, when we were going through the 50s and 60s, you had a lot of these creature features, and we were really afraid of all of these, you know, blobs and kind of creatures from other planets as we were expanding our horizon into the space exploration. And then you have, you know, zombies that came about, and there's been a lot of social critique on how that's kind of representing this, you know, changing social patterns and fears around all different kinds of cultural shifts. But it can also be an issue of habituation. So you can see that characters kind of wane and wax and wane depending on the generation. So, for example, you know, this generation is just, we see zombies all the time. So we're eventually going to become habituated. They're not going to be as scary as they used to be. I think that's kind of happening right now. I think we've got a few more years left with zombies, and then it's going to be like, okay, zombies are over. But then in 20 years, you know, when zombies have been away for a while, we'll probably see a return because it'll be new for that generation. So you see the same thing with, like, ghosts. Witches seem to be really, you know, popular right now. That is kind of really exciting to a lot of people. And so you see kind of the, as each generation is exposed to some kind of real iconic characters, the popularity will rise and fall. I'm fascinated with aliens, that we don't really find aliens as scary anymore. They are a little bit, but I'm just waiting. I'm like, when are aliens going to be scary again? So you see a kind of change over time. I'm not sure if that addresses what you were looking
kind
for.
Kind of, yes. I was looking for more because, I mean, I know, like, the characters and everything are scary. I wasn't talking so much about, like, a character, like a clown, but, like, an underlying emotional thing that would maybe tie zombies or the ghosts or whatever
death.
Together.
Yeah, people are afraid of death. They're afraid of dying. And so a lot of the characters, and you see this across cultures, too. Each culture has kind of... The monster that really represents death, and you know, we have several of those monsters, and a lot of the biggest kinds of monsters are essentially dealing with either coming back to life, living forever, But it somehow defying the laws of nature. And that is terrifying to us because we are so afraid of death. And we, I think, try to kind of exercise some of these fears through creating these characters, you know, vampires that can live forever. That seems so enticing to a society that is so obsessed with youth and beauty. So I think that death definitely is one of those unifying themes that, that ghosts, I mean, it's just, we're afraid of death.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm.
Good evening. First off, to the audience, how many haunters do we have in a room right now? Make some noise. Me too. I love that. Unfortunately, I also have a day job, which unfortunately is a clinical psychologist at a maximum security prison. So you want to see some fear, come to work with me someday. Just speaking about haunted house fear, I mean, kind of like what they call the eustress of fear. You go to a haunted house, and yes, it's, you'll be scared if you want it to be, but you know you'll be safe at the end of it. No one actually will try to kill you.
Right.
Some of the common themes I've noticed with that, one is, you know, closed spaces. You know, the hallways get narrow. The ceiling gets, you think it's lower than it really is. Darkness. You can throw in everything else there, spiders, snakes, and everything. But the big one I see, it's just a perception, is that lack of control seems to kind of really turn us on. So from a psych standpoint, does that mean that all these goers are just really S&M subbies that are paying for a thrill? I'm not trying to be Freudian, but that just kind of popped in my head there.
No, I think that, that is one of those things like a Venn diagram. You can have these two things overlap, but they're not, you know, necessarily the same thing. And it's, I don't think necessarily the same population. Loss of control is so scary because, you know, that's how we know we're safe is when we have control over our environment, over our actions. And so it's scary when we don't. But I don't think that it's inextricably linked to any kind of S&M kind of behaviors. I think that it's just a, you know, we generally are frightened when we don't have control.
Yeah, control is an illusion. You get right down to it. All you're looking for is what goes on between your ears. And just last part of the question, vampire, sparkly or no?
No.
Very good.
So my question is about the intersection between anxiety and fear.
Oh, yeah.
So as I stand here, I'm like, oh, my gosh, this is the intersection of anxiety and fear for me. But do you find in a lot of your studies that fear is really a hyperbolization of what induces anxiety in a lot of people, and how do we counter anxiety in the population and its realization and what causes us to have fear?
The more that I look at kind of fear and anxiety, the more different I really think that they are. And that, you know, anxiety really is just this continual kind of the stress that we have. And you know, talking about measurement, you can measure the level of cortisol in people to kind of see kind of their stress load. And it's very different than experiencing fear. And I think that I think a lot of people assume that people who struggle with issues of anxiety are not going to enjoy fearful or thrilling activities. And I've seen that that's not the case. We have a lot of soldiers, actually, who have come through the haunt, soldiers with PTSD, who say that this is really, that it's really cathartic for them. And I think that that's really interesting. I think that there, you know, could potentially be some sort of relationship between, you know, people who are experiencing a lot of anxiety and then the benefit that comes through going through a fearful situation where it feels like there's closure. It feels like, okay, this is, you know, wrapped up. This is done. But I don't know. I think that, you know, I wish that a lot of the historical data that I'm looking at had really tried to tease out anxiety-inducing experiences or somehow figure out a way to talk about anxiety versus fear, because I think that they're very different. I don't know if that, does that answer, kind of?
Thank you.
Uh-huh.
How often do people get punched out at the scare house?
not often at all. Do you mean actors or customers?
Customers.
That does happen. You know, it is very instinctual for a lot of people to lash out when they're scared. And it's something that we do talk to our actors about, and we let them know that it may happen. Now, we do have a really strict policy that if it does, we have to notify security immediately because, you know, the person could then go on to the next scare and punch them, and we don't want that to happen. But usually if you're like, you know, just hold it in, just stop it. It'll be okay. But for some people, that is the instinct, you know, especially, you know, if you are approached from behind and you turn around, you just, our bodies are so ready to take on that threat. So, yeah. But it doesn't happen like a ton.
So, I'm curious to what extent empathy might factor in to the fear experience, because the fight or flight response to a danger to oneself seems pretty direct and clear, but to what extent does the observation of somebody else in danger, especially somebody like one's child being in danger, factor into it?
Yeah. Empathy fascinates me because, and I forget who said this, but they said that empathy is the invisible hand that moves civilization forward, and I really believe that because you know, it is because of empathy that we, you know, connect with each other, that we, you know, communicate. I mean, we're social beings because we are empathetic. And we have mirror neurons. So basically, when we are watching something, we are experiencing it as though it were ourselves. Not to the same extent. It's not the same intensity. But we do. We can experience it. And that's why we can learn from listening to others' scary stories, because we are experiencing it to a bit of a lesser degree. I think that empathy is critical. I think that the role that it plays in kind of enjoying fear is really in the social aspect. So if you are with your friends and you're going through this and you're kind of helping them and you're feeling what they're feeling, you're both experiencing this at the same time, it's creating that greater social bond. But, you know, on the other hand, empathy can be the cause for, you know, extreme anxiety. You know, if you are witnessing someone going through something, that can be really terrifying. If it's real, you know, if it's a situation that is very tragic, you know, that can feel incredibly scary. But it is because of empathy that we enjoy scary movies. You know, we're watching these things happen to characters on screen. And we're experiencing it ourselves, you know, and so we're the ones who are waiting for the person to come up to our window and break through. And so it's those mirror neurons. It's because we can relate. So, yeah, I think it's very important.
If all fear is accompanied by endorphins and oxytocin, why do phobias develop?
That's a great question. So phobias, and they've been trying to figure out, you know, whether phobias are learned or whether there are some genetic predispositions to phobias. They found that they just did this study. Again, it was with rats, so it's not we can't completely generalize it to people. But they introduced cat pheromones to rats and basically conditioned a fear response in these rats so that whenever they smelled the cat pheromones, they would become afraid. And they found that by the third generation, so this is the babies of the babies, they were also afraid of cats. And so that suggests that there is some sort of genetic kind of component to the things that we are afraid of. But again, this is rats. This is, you know, it's hard to know. But yeah, there, you know, many phobias absolutely can be socially conditioned. So you can have an experience that is very traumatic. Those same chemicals that are making us feel good are also making those experiences stick in our brains. And if it's bad, you know, if it's a bad, tragic thing, then that can create a very strong negative association to that stimulus and turn into a phobia. So just because endorphins and oxytocin and all of these things can make us feel good, it doesn't necessarily mean that the experience that they're occurring in is going to be a good one, and one that we'll remember fondly. So we can develop phobias because of our experiences, but the real question now is, you know, are we potentially genetically predisposed to some phobias? And phobias can be absolutely devastating. I know in a lot of the work that I'm doing, you know, people will ask me, well, you know, what about the downsides of fear? Like, fear can be really traumatic and terrifying, and phobias are, you know, debilitating and interfering with the functioning of everyday life. And I am very sensitive to that, and I really appreciate that because they can be really bad.
You talked a lot about the acuteness that's associated with fear. What about fear that's more chronic? And I'm thinking of bullying for adults or children.
Oh, yeah. So that, I think, really represents itself in, you know, when you experience a degree of anxiety that you eventually have a panic attack. And you see this with kids. The number of kids who stay home from school because of bullying every day is really, really sad. And it's because they are so afraid of and this is so phobia. You become so afraid of having that reaction when you confront that stimulus that it inhibits your functioning. So, for example, if you are afraid of a bully, you're going to avoid that situation at all costs. And that's more, again, kind of avoiding the fight or flight, avoiding that movement into that automatic kind of response. And so people then become locked in that state of kind of paralysis around a fear. And so I think that that's more living in that state of anxiety, which then can turn into, you know, something like a panic attack, which is really debilitating.
It kind of creates a culture of silence, which is different from when you go to the scare house and you know, scream your head off.
Yeah.
So it's a totally different response.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay.
What's a cheap, funky smell easily recreated that will elicit a fear reaction?
Oh, gosh. Let's see. So, where's Nino? Nino, you can probably answer that. We buy our scents, so, you know, you can purchase... Flavor and smell engineering is an entire field of study that is incredibly fascinating because we can manufacture any smell or scent that we want. Doing it on your own, a DIY solution, I'm not familiar with. Any other questions?
Sorry, does the scare you?
Yes. So one of the reasons that I... you know, got into all of this is because I love going to haunted houses. I love doing scary and thrilling things. And it still scares me a lot. I would consider myself somebody who does have a very sensitive kind of startle reflex, so it doesn't take very much to kind of scare me. But it's very different because then people ask me what I'm afraid of, and that's a little bit harder. But I get scared easily, but I don't necessarily know what I'm afraid of. So, any other questions? right now, I think that I think it finally did hit me just this weekend that I'm going to ride this water slide in Kansas City, and it's the tallest water slide in the world, and it's 17 stories, and I'm going on opening day, and I'm hoping to be one of the first people to ride it. And I started really thinking about that, and I was thinking, you know what? This could be one of those anomalous kind of tragic experiences that they did not account for. And so right now, I'm a little bit afraid of that. There's apparently a video that kind of shows you the drop, but it is just literally straight down. And so that sounds a little bit scary. Yeah, there's you know, a lot of research being done on that very thing, the overstimulation and the effect on our sensitivity to violence in particular is usually how they're studying it, and whether we are becoming overstimulated. And it is something that I think about a lot, and we talk about it a lot in my human growth and development class because, younger and younger kids are being stimulated so much artificially, you know, so that means they're being put in front of screens from a very young age, and so basically they're not really having to generate any kind of self-stimulation. They're not using their imagination as much. They're not just engaging with the environment around them, but they're watching a screen that is kind of stimulating them. And I think that, and again, you know, there's a lot of research looking at the impact of overstimulation, but I think that for a lot of people that I talk to and some of the research that I've read, we have, you know, so many passive things that are stimulating us that when we do get the opportunity to go out and do something, we're enjoying it. So, you know, if you get to go out and go on an amusement park ride or go through a haunted house, it's a more active kind of experience. But you do find that, you know, that we are exposed to greater amounts of, you know, graphic or gory material, and then the question of what that's doing to us. And the studies are not really conclusive. You see differences in age group. So, for example, you know, the impact of watching violent movies on adolescents is different than the impact of adults watching violent movies. You know, in children, it increases violent behavior temporarily. In adults, it doesn't seem to have an impact. So the research is not conclusive in what this is doing to our sense our sensitivity to this material. But also, you know, at the end of the day, many of us really have not witnessed real violence, right in front of us, you know, and it's so exaggerated and dramatized and over the top in our movies and our video games that we've never really seen real violence, and that is still, I think, you know, something that when you do see is very terrifying. So I'm curious to see what a lot of the research is going to say, because again, you read one study and it says no impact, you read another and it says yes, it's impacting. So, anything else?
Any other questions?
The news media, I got a big mouth. But the news media, all the negativity, everything, the fear of it all, I understand it's to make money, but what's your opinion, the long-term effect like on children being afraid all the time, like they're afraid to walk down the street?
Yeah. Yeah, and there was a really good article written in The Atlantic about 2 weeks ago that looked at the plight of the overprotected kid, I think was the name of the article had something about the overprotected kid, and the consequences of kids, you know, growing up in fear and also then in an environment where they are not having as many opportunities to challenge themselves and fail and build that sense of resilience. So the article that was looking at this was focused primarily on playgrounds, that we've created such a safe world for our children, really, that they are not hurting themselves and then getting back up, right? So if you think about a playground when you were a kid, it probably had, you know, monkey bars and, you know, just maybe gravel and wood chips, and you could fall and you could hurt yourself. Right. And you'd get back up, and you'd have a bruised knee, you'd have a scraped elbow, but you would overcome that, and then you would develop a feeling of resilience afterwards, and that would give you confidence that you could then overcome future challenges. And our kids today aren't having as many of those types of experiences, but the real challenge is then providing them these experiences that give them that opportunity to challenge themselves, to fail, to overcome, but in a way that's not going to be traumatic. And so... And what has ended up happening is that, yeah, you have a lot of kids who are petrified and then have not a lot of confidence in their abilities to withstand difficult times. And trying to figure out how to create that balance, I mean, it's not my area that I focus in. It is something that I'm interested in and that I think is really important to think about, because you want your kids to be confident in themselves and have that hardiness, that resilience. And so it you know, I think that, you know, just monitoring media usage for adolescents is important. But it does, I do get concerned. There's a movement to create these playgrounds that offer these kinds of opportunities to hurt yourself in a safe way, basically. So, but it also encourages kids to be more imaginative in their play. So instead of having this perfectly manufactured and sculpted playground that has rubber and everything is solid, and you see that a lot of playgrounds today don't even have the monkey bars. You can't climb. You know, everything is so safe, and so they're trying to build playgrounds today that, you know, like here are a bunch of tires. Do something with them, and that can kind of, you know, meet a lot of those goals of creating confidence, resilience, imagination, creativity.
Oh, I just have one comment, and you of course can't comment on my comment, but this, as we wind the evening down, it made me think of about 15 years ago when I was privileged to hear Stephen King here in Pittsburgh, and he's a master, because he reminded everybody, as they went out into the parking lot, as dark as it was, he said, you know, you just might want to look underneath your car because sometimes people hide there. I mean, I don't want to make you afraid, but that could happen. Oh, and when you open the door of your car, you might want to check behind the seats because people have been known to be there too.
Does everybody look under your car?
He was great.
I just wanted to mention that I just moved from Berkeley, and so I lived right next to the last adventure playground in America. And yes, I gave my 7-year-old kid a hammer and a saw.
Yeah.
And you send them out with paint, and you tell them, you know, pick up any bent nails on the ground.
Right.
And,
right.
They swing. And one of the parents next to me, they were like teaching their kid to swing as high as they could
and
then jump off the swing because, you know, that'd be cool.
Right.
Basically, so we had a playground full of kids creating their own playground,
and
they weren't hurting themselves.
Yeah, and if they do, they're pretty, you know, bendable. They'll heal.
Again, not so much a question, but an observation. Working with sociopaths, I got a different kind of perspective on how fear motivates. Fear only motivates if there's a consequence. If we think there's not going to be any true consequence, then fear doesn't matter. As far as how we deal with it and how we respond to it and our kids and such, I find that if you don't deal with the fear, it leads to anger. Fear only lasts for so long. After a while, you get tired of it, and society's full of that. You look at the Nazis, look at communism. After a while, people got tired of it, and they start going against it. Problem is, then, is what do you do with that anger? And honestly, I can't take credit for this. Yoda said it best. You know what I'm going to talk about here. I'm sorry, it's from episode 1, so, you know. Fear leads to anger. Anger leads to hate. Hate leads to suffering.
Yeah.
So if you give in to the anger, and unfortunately we see that in the news with shootings and stabbings and domestic terrorism, for lack of a better term, people decide to take their hate and put it out there because they want you to feel the pain that they felt.
Yeah.
So the issue comes up, I mean, is the dark side more powerful? No, but it is more seductive and faster, and that's the tricky part.
Yeah. Well, my background in studying social distance preferences was definitely trying to address some of those larger issues that how, you know, we end up fearing people who are different, and then that turns into, you know, differences in what rights people get and treating people differently based on essentially fear. And so that is kind of my background. So,
all right. Thanks, Margie.
Thank you. Thanks, everybody.